Hey everyone, this is Sheila with Rowan Holistic Healing and Wellness. You can find me at www.rowan-wellness.com, and that's where you'll go to find classes and schedule a session if that's something that seems interesting to you. I can also be found on social media. I'm already stumbling. Facebook is Rowan Holistic Healing and Wellness. Instagram is at Rowan Holistic Healing. Tumblr is also at Rowan Holistic Healing. And Twitter is at Sheila Rumpel. Okay, and hopefully soon to be on YouTube. So fingers crossed. This has been such, I know I have said this in probably every podcast so far, but this has been such a journey for me in terms of, spirit leading into places where we are not entirely comfortable, kind of taking us to our edge. And so for me, I'm an introvert. I'm much more comfortable writing. And so when I do these, you know, I'm also kind of a perfectionist. So when I do these, this isn't my natural mode of communication. And then I get super like, that was very clunky and awkward and I want to redo it. And so anyway, so thank you for your patience. If you have listened to some of the past ones, I know that they are probably not super easy to listen to. But the information is good and hopefully you're getting out of it, some good stuff despite, some stylistic, and technical difficulties. So hopefully they're getting better with each one. So I wanted to do today, this is kind of a little bit lighter one than the past one. So far I've done a lot of work with 2020, talking about different survival archetypes that are active. I just uploaded the one on thought forms. So that's a really interesting one. I go into what thought forms are. And they're essentially, you know, these parasitic-like energetic patterns that have over time kind of, they derive energy from humans, but over time they develop enough mass that they can actually kind of direct emotion or elicit emotion and from that standpoint, direct actions and behaviors. So jealousy is one. And, you know, and I also presented the consideration that, you know, our ideas of these evil beings might be nothing more than thought forms that we have been contributing this energy to, and that if we withdraw our energy, that thought form, it disintegrates. So those are past podcasts. Like I said, the episode 4, which is the thought forms, that's a brand new one that went up today. This one is just going to be on just some basic symbols that come up a lot, have been coming up a lot recently. And so the first thing is why do we talk so much in using symbols and archetypes? Well, number one, this is how spirit communicates with us. So as someone who is clairaudient, I do, I think it's important to share this, by the way, because how I have gotten to where I am was not through a teacher, and it was really through my own experience. And there were aspects of what I had experienced that I just thought everybody experienced that. And then there are other aspects that, I don't know. I was just surprised to hear other people say them. So to give you an example, I'm not going to come up with any right now. Sorry. I wasn't planning to go down that road. But anyway, one of the aspects of this is that for people that are, you know, it really depends on what your particular sense is. So we have rolled all of these extra sensory perceptions up kind of into this one little category, but they can manifest in different ways. And so someone who is clairaudient, which is one of my dominant senses, does actually hear words. But if you're something else, like clairvoyant, they will tend to communicate, spirit tends to communicate more in symbols and images. And so being able to decipher what those images means really lends a lot of power to how they communicate. Now you can have multiple. So often what will happen is I will hear part verbally, part of an explanation, but meanwhile, I'm also getting an image. And so it just lends some depth and layer to messages from spirit. Okay, so, but why symbols and why archetypes? Because symbols tend to be fairly universal, so they're not couched in languages, in the specificity of language or nuance and things like that. They're universal. So we see, we can recognize the image of a house and know what that means, regardless of language, regardless where that house is in the world. And if you think about how many different things, like if you think about different types of houses that we can see and still immediately recognize that it is a house and what its purpose is. So symbols are just very powerful, concise. It's a very simple, concise language, if you want to call it that, that it's easy, that it incorporates easily into our conceptual framework of the world. It's very easy to attribute meaning to and get away from stylistic, nuanced verbal language. Okay, archetypes are the same thing. Archetypes are kind of an expanded, like if you took a symbol and bumped it out a layer or even maybe multiple. Archetypes are just like an agglomeration of symbols into form like a pattern. Okay, so we can have a lot of archetypes, and I already did a podcast on that, so you might want to go check that out. But we can have a lot of different archetypes. We can have personality archetypes, place archetypes, which is really, again, like if you start talking about a mountain, you can really see how it's a symbol with that's kind of fleshed out into this archetypal pattern. So we can have, archetypes that are personality, places, ideas, things like that. So, okay. Again, I always have this dream that these are just going to be so smooth. no stumbles and bumbles and all of that, but okay. All right. So in this podcast, there are two main symbols that I want to talk about. And I guess, like I said, with the mountain, sometimes it's a very fine line between whether it's a symbol or an archetype, and sometimes it doesn't really matter. But two important symbols for us are going to be the house and the symbology of a door, the symbolism of a door. And so I want to talk about those because, first of all, if you're doing this work, especially if you're not working with a practitioner, which is fine. That's really, as I mentioned earlier, that's really how this all started for me. I was just seeing things, hearing things, knowing things. And eventually, in some ways I was surprised to find out, like, not everybody dreams the way that I dream. So I have very, very vivid dreams. So that was shocking to me to find out that not everybody dreams the way that I dream. And then, if you are someone who has been going through this, for a long time, like I just remember some point in childhood being surprised that, wow, how come people don't know the things that I know? it was so obvious to me, and how have other people missed it? And it took a while before I realized that not everybody picks up on those. And it's not because other people don't have them. It's usually because they've been closed up or covered over, especially when we grow up in a family or society or a social construct, like could be religion or school, where those things are shut down. Imagination, that's in the realm of imagination, and so we're going to shut it down. Okay, so the symbolism of the house will pop up often in dreams. So again, if you're working on your own and not with a practitioner, one of the things that you might have noticed people will tend to be very vivid dreamers, and the house will pop up quite a bit. And so why the house and what is the house? Okay, so I want to read. So Jung was one of the, okay, he's certainly not the first. I just want to make sure I say this clearly. He is not the first to rely on symbolism. You know, we have a long, in our, at least in our written history, we have a long history of storytellers using symbolism. When we look at, I'm going to forget the actual name, but when we look at some of the stories where the stories would be written around these archetypal animals, right? Where the animals would be the main character. And the reason that these artists wrote in this way is that when we look at symbols, so not only does it take us out of the realm of linguistics, so obviously the stories are told in a language, but when we get to the level of symbolism, we can see very clearly without emotional attachment. And so symbols are able to unplug us from our energetic attachment and reactions to things. So for instance, to use a coyote, to symbolize a coyote versus a human aspect, you know, we might take offense or feel defensive to be told that we're acting in a certain way, but to hear that same story told through the archetype of the coyote and plugs us enough from our emotion and that defensiveness that we can see the imagery more clearly. And so again, that's why that imagery is used so often by spirit, because it does unplug us emotionally. So when we dream, and dreams can be a variety of different things. Quickly, this isn't a podcast on dreams, but I've totally gone off track. I'm looking at my notes now going, whoa, this isn't where I was supposed to be. But dreams, we'll just do an aside really quick. Dreams can be, in my experience, one of three different things. Yes, dreams can be a complete just overspill of energy and emotions and things that have happened through the day. So it's just like that further processing enough to get it out, or to put it into memory. So there are some links between dreams and memory. Dreams can also be prophetic in nature. And I separate these two. They can be prophetic, meaning they can kind of, you can see what's coming through them. And I've had a lot of those where I can see, and it's usually through symbolism. It certainly involves people and people that I know and love, but it's also at a level that is a little bit more couched in symbolism. So just a little bit removed emotionally. Often, not always. And then the third is that we do a lot of soul and spirit level work through the dreams, and or we may be visiting, or we may be visited by other various, you know, our soul guides. I've been visited before in dreams by guides, people who I have known who have passed. Even occasionally, sometimes people I don't know that have passed, but they're connected to someone I'm close to in life. And, so dreams can be a variety of things. And so these symbols can come in as different, in different ways through those various, types of dreams. Okay. I need to get back to my notes before I get too rambly. Okay. So the house symbolism didn't originate. See, this is where I got off track the first time. Okay. So we have a long history of using symbols and archetypes, but one of the, again, pioneer isn't the right word, but one of the people who really brought this, as a tool for understanding the self, was Carl Jung. Okay. And one of the things that he did, he actually did talk about the symbolism of of houses. And so I want to read. So this came from his book, I believe, In Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. So Memories, Dreams, and Reflections was the writing. And this was, he talks about the house. And so he says, this is a quote, "I was in a house I did not know, which had two stories. It was, quote, my house. I found myself in the upper story where there was a kind of salon furnished with fine old pieces in Rococo style. On the walls hung a number of precious old paintings. I wondered that this should be my house and thought, not bad. But then it occurred to me that I did not know what the lower floor looked like. Descending the stairs, I reached the ground floor. There, everything was much older. I realized that this part of the house must date from about the 15th or 16th century. The furnishes were medieval. The floors were of red brick. Everywhere it was rather dark. I went from one room to another thinking, now I really must explore the whole house. I came upon a heavy door and opened it. Beyond it, I discovered a stone stairway that led down into a cellar. Descending again, I found myself in a beautifully vaulted room, which looked exceedingly ancient. Examining the walls, I discovered layers of brick among the ordinary stone blocks and chips of brick in the mortar. As soon as I saw this, I knew that the walls dated from Roman times. My interest by now was intense. I looked more closely at the floor. It was of stone slabs, and in one of these I discovered a ring. When I pulled it, the stone slab lifted, and again I saw a stairway of narrow steps leading down to the depths. These two I descended and entered a low cave cut into rock. Thick dust lay on the floor, and in the dust were scattered bones and broken pottery, like remains of a primitive culture. I discovered two human skulls, obviously very old and half disintegrated. Then I awoke." So this was one of, my understanding is that this dream was one of the first that he had of the house, and where he attributed to, he attributed the house to the subconscious. And apparently he had a discussion with Freud about this dream. And this is, I don't know, allegedly where he and Freud started to part ways in terms of their theories. Okay, so when we listen to that presentation, that dream narrative by Jung, we see that if we take each level, we can see that there are different aspects of the level or different floors. And so one of the ways, for my interpretation, now this may not be completely in alignment with Jung, but in my experience with houses, when we dream about a house, that's what I'm going to go into right now. So I kind of skipped ahead a few minutes ago, but coming back to that idea of the dream and what exists in the different levels. So basement tends to be, for me, the basement tends to really be the unconscious or the subconscious. So that is where, okay, first of all, in older houses particularly, the basement would be where a lot of the guts of the house were. So when I say guts, I'm talking about electrical systems, plumbing, there's a lot of insulation down there, HVAC, furnace, things like that. So a lot of that was in the basement. Okay, and often the basement didn't have a lot of windows. It tended to be darker. Okay, so for me, the basement is where we relegate the shadow, which makes sense because if we look at the basement as that kind of unconscious, subconscious level, it is the shadow. That's where the shadow tends to emerge. It's like nobody's paying attention. It's able to creep out. Okay, so the basement is where we have the guts of our house, our mechanisms, so our survival. Again, our energetic system is down there, all kinds. It has access to our biology, the mechanisms of our body functioning, and also is where we'll find the shadow. So it's the base layer, and it also forms the foundation. Main level of the house is typically what we present to the world. So think about you know, where the front door is. This is your foyer, your living room, the spaces people could come into if you were to have guests over. Okay, so that is kind of your presentation to the world. And then you'll have other areas of the house where if you had guests over, you would not tend to bring them. And so, and typically you can say those are upper levels, but they won't always be. You just have to see how it presents in your dreams, but you will know that whether or not it's a level that you would have or a room that you would invite someone into. Okay, and then you could have upper levels, and those would be, and so in the upper levels, we might find our higher self, our inner mind. Again, sanctuaries where we might not let people in. Okay, and then, so let's say we're dreaming about the house. Some other things that might pop up and pop up quite often, in my opinion, or in my experience rather, are two things. The house is the symbology through which we are able to access our soul and to really see. And so sometimes from a human perspective, we get a little wary that there could be parts of us that we aren't seeing, or sometimes we'll know that we have a gift that's been locked away, but we just don't know how to get to it. And so when we're in a dream state and we can utilize this symbolism of the house, it is a mechanism for our soul, our unconscious higher self, and our conscious self to kind of come together. And so a lot of times when you're dreaming about a house, what the topic of the dream will be, it's not so much exploring these various levels, though of course you will find yourself in those, or you know, they can come into play. But more often it is that you have these undiscovered aspects. So you might have an undiscovered room that you find. I have that a lot. I often find I'll have like secret passages, or a room I didn't know was there, or even like a whole wing. And it's always like, whoo, this is so exciting. And then off I go to explore. And so those undiscovered rooms or parts of the house are, for whatever reason, parts of you that have been closed off up until now. And it can be a variety of things. It could be an archetypal pattern that you weren't really quite aware of that might be now, that has always been there, but is now rising more to the surface, because they will do that. You have a variety of archetypes. And some will, through the course of your life, some will be more prominent, and they just, there's an ebb and flow to them. Some will come up in prominence, some will sink down. And so sometimes as we have an archetype that is rising up into prominence, it will appear as this new room or this new wing of a house. Tunnels, hidden tunnels can symbolize like this journey of birthing that, you know, like think the birth canal. So it's that transition into that new aspect. You know, it could also be, I think really, it really is most often like archetypal, but it can even be like past lives that are coming into, or parallel lives even, that are somehow touching on our current life in some way. Or influencing, where there's a mutual, you know, and the influencing goes both ways. So there's like some kind of mutual influencing that's happening there. Also, when you're traveling through these dream houses, the other thing that I find in my own dreams is that a lot of times, so I had one recently that really stuck with me, but I was in the attic, and this attic was filled with stuff. And to be honest, I had just watched like an episode of, I always forget the name of it whenever I talk about it. It's like the junk people, the hoarder show, but it's these people that go to these places where people have hoarded a lot of stuff and saved it. And they go through and they Pickers or something. Maybe it's Pickers, American Pickers. Okay, so I had a dream like that. Like this attic was filled with stuff. And it was like as I was walking through, and it was difficult to walk through, I knew that a lot of the stuff was just junk. But I also knew that there was something in that attic that had a lot of value and I needed to find it, but I had to dig through all this junk to get to it. And so if you have that type of dream where there's a lot of stuff, it can be a sign that you're just a little too cluttered. Like, so for me, that was in the attic. So that's going to be like my mind, that my mind is a little bit cluttered and it's making it difficult to get to where I need to go. There's something of value in there, probably multiple things of value, but it's challenging for me to get to that gift because I'm having to wade through too much stuff. So that's a sign of clearing, you know, clearing the mind. So that's how that symbolism can be really useful. So that house symbolism, in understanding, not only your dreams, but kind of using those dreams as a launching point or as directional signs to where you need to go in terms of your work. Okay, another symbolism that I want to talk about quickly is one that Carolyn Mace uses a lot in her work. And she uses the symbolism of a building. So it has a lot of commonality to the house. But the thing that's cool about the building is that, but the way that she uses the building is really cool because she uses the building to explain the different levels of perception. So she is also using that idea of, you know, where we talked about with the house, where you have a basement and you have a main level and you have an upper level. She really brings it all above ground within the building. And she talks about the seven layers of the house. And so you can coordinate those seven layers to a lot of different things, including the chakra or energetic energy systems. But one of the things that I just think is so beautiful in that, in using that symbol, is that she talks about this idea that you have to get to the upper floors in order to get a more clear perspective of what's happening. So she uses the building in a crowded city like New York City, and how if you're at the first floor looking out, you know, what do you see? You see a lot of people, you see busy streets, you know, that are packed with cars. It might even be gridlocked. This is where you're going to see all the trash and, you know, what else? And when you look out, you just really can't see far. You know what I mean? Because there's so much happening. There's people, there's cars, and then there's going to be another building right there. You know, there's just not space. So that lower level, that first level correlates to the tribal, you know, like if you were looking at it through the chakras, you're looking at the root chakra, which has to do with our survival in a tribe. So it's very tribal in nature. Kind of the same story when you go to the second, you know, like it changes a little bit. You're up a little bit higher. You're not seeing all the cars, but I mean, unless you're looking specifically, but when you look directly out, you know, now you're above the cars and you're a little bit above the people, but now's when you're going to start to see the people you're close to. So if you were to look across, you might see one or two people in their apartment. So these would be like our intimate relationships, but again, still at the street level, still really not able to see very far, still very tribal in nature. Okay, let's compare. I don't want to go through the whole building. I mean, I think you can see as you go higher and higher, you start to get more of a view. And so if you're on the upper level of the floor, and I know in New York, if you were to go up to level floor, if you were in New York and you were to go up to the seventh floor, you're probably really not going to see much. But let's just pretend that the seventh floor is the top floor. What do you see from the top floor? Well, you can see out. You know, you can see out over the whole city and you can see how all these buildings fit together and how all the roads seem to connect in this fantastic pattern of getting here, getting there. You know, you can't see that when you're at the bottom floor. You can barely see the next street, the next intersection, much less three or four down, you know, and how they all connect to one another. That is something you can see, though, from the upper floor. You can see how all these streets connect and how the other transportation systems factor in. And you can see the park, and you can see trees, and you can see the plan, the overall schematic of how it's all laid out and how it works together. And it can be very difficult to see, if not impossible to see, from the lower levels. And so remembering that those lower levels are very tribal, we can be very constrained in a tribal mindset, and it can be difficult to see the grander scheme of things. One that's more empowering to the individual versus, you know, keeping everybody in these tight constraints of this is your block and this is all you can see that exists. Okay. So you see yourself not just within the tribe, but within the larger global collective, symbolically. For me, so Mace presents that as a building. When I have done journeys, it's often presented to me as a mountain. And so, of course, the higher up you go on the mountain, the better the perspective is, right? And so when they've shown me this, they've shown me that a lot of people, you know, if you consider the whole vista, you know, you'll have the mountain and then you'll have a valley, and they'll show me that in myself included. I mean, I'm included in this was my journey, and I don't even remember what it was about, but it was something that I was particularly stuck in. And they showed me that essentially how I was trying to view it was like I was in the valley, but not only in the valley, but I had like dug down into, and I was in like this hole, and I was down in the hole thinking that I could see, and I couldn't see anything at all. And so they showed me this process of climbing out of the hole. Now I'm in the valley, which can be quite beautiful from there too. But then contrasting that view from the valley with the view from the mountain. And very few of us as humans get to the mountaintop. I mean, that really is the view from a very high, high level that I think, I don't want to say it's impossible for a human to get there, but it is very, very challenging. Exceedingly difficult because we're incarnate. And so the view from the mountain is really the view that your guides see. It's the view of spirit. And that is why they're helping us, you know, because they do have that high level view, and it's like they're the lookout or whatever. And so they're calling that information down to us when they give us spiritual guidance, among other things. I mean, they serve obviously other purposes as well, but that mountain view, just, you know, we can get to a mountaintop. We can't necessarily get to the highest mountaintop in terms of our viewpoint. One other symbol that might be helpful in as you do your work, and one that I use in my sessions with clients, is this. I use the symbolism of a tree, and I call it the soul tree. And so this tree, and I like it because it's a natural living entity, being. And so I like it from that perspective. That's why I use it. And so I don't use it in quite the same way in terms of, you know, going into the consciousness and unconsciousness. But the way that I use the soul tree is that it connects, it represents the self. And so when I say self, I mean like self, capital S, capital E, capital L, capital F, like self in the largest aspect you can think. So we often call that the higher self, or the level of the self at the level of spirit, but it would be the self in all the various timelines, lifetimes, dimensions. And so it is all these projections that we have, and coalesced into the spirit. And so when I take clients into sessions to visit the soul tree, it really is connecting them back into their spirit at this grand level. And there is so much empowerment and healing and insight that is available because we forget like that even exists. It's like, I always liken it to like the spirit incarnate in a human body. So imagine like the tip of your pinky is like your incarnate soul. And so, and imagine that you have slammed your pinky in a door, right? And so it's throbbing and it's painful and it really, your pinky hurts so bad, you have forgotten that the rest of the body even exists. Like your focus is only on the tip of your pinky. That really is, or often is, what this incarnate experience is for us. It is painful to be a human. It is that way by design. It's through challenge that we learn. And so we tend to forget, you know, we are focused only on this body. We're focused only on the tip of our pinky that hurts. And we forget that we have this whole larger soul aspect, spirit aspect that is us. And that is the rest of our body, you know, in the analogy. And so the soul tree represents that spirit self and connecting back and remembering that it's there. And so using that symbol, the heart of the tree is the trunk. The heart of the spirit is represented by the trunk. As you climb up, rather than using climbing up as like accessing higher consciousness, remember this is all the consciousness together. So in this analogy, when you climb up, the branches get you to your different manifestations. So if someone is looking at past lives, I would take them into the branches. So it's the different manifestations of the spirit in different realms and dimensions and all of that. Leaves are gifts. So the leaves represent your innate gifts. They're the nourishment for the tree. They're bringing in the light and converting it to energy for the tree. So those are the gifts. And you can see, if you are sitting somewhere where you can see it, look out and see a tree, look out and see how many leaves there are. That's how many gifts you have. And so if someone is really needing to see those gifts, again, we go up into the upper part of the tree. And then when you go down into the roots, this is not only the place where you're nourished, it's also the place to get to your ancestors, not only in this lifetime, but in other lifetimes as well. So this is kind of your support system and your another form of nourishment, right? So the gifts are, the leaves are one type of nourishment, but then you also get nourishment through the roots. And then we can look at the space around and underneath the tree to look at boundaries. We can look at the overall state of health by looking at the soil and the moisture of the soil and the things like that. You know, if it's really thick, not thick, but, you know, the black loamy type soil, or is it thin and sandy, things like that. So it's just really clues. We just use it as a symbol to get back into the spirit and really see where we are. And you can see the forest, you know, so it's not just about the tree, but you can see the tree as part of a larger network of forest that extends. So that can give clues to the position in the tribe or the position in this cosmic community. So that's another way, another symbol that I use in my work to represent the spirit and the soul, and that you may find useful too, that, you know, you may be more like me where you prefer kind of that more biological living representation of the soul versus the inanimate house. Okay, so the other symbol that I wanted to go through or talk about is the symbol of a door. So door comes up a lot for me in so many different ways. Oh my gosh, when I started thinking about it, I was like, wow, this thing pops up for me all the time. And So I'll just talk about some of the ways, and I'll tell you. So when we do, first of all, doors represent a lot of different things. Let me go through that first. Doors represent boundaries and mechanisms for protection. And so when I'm talking about boundaries and protection, I'm talking about, you know, if you think about your house, going back to that analogy, if you think about your house, if you're somebody that just leaves your door open, you know, what's going to happen is people can just walk in, you have bugs coming in, you might have birds flying in. So you have stuff coming into your space. You might be good with that. I mean, but you may not be, you know, not everybody is good with having stuff just coming into their space. It can be very overwhelming. Conversely, you might be someone who really like bars the door. And so in that case, you might be feeling a little unsafe in your home and you're really trying to keep things out. So doors, looking at doors symbolically from that perspective, can give a lot of clues to how we're feeling in terms of boundaries and our level of safety. Now, I use doors a lot in my sessions with clients, especially the phone and the online sessions where we're doing journeys, because when we do journeys, I mean, you'll hear me say, like, one of the first things I'll say is find a door or portal. We go through, and then I say close it once you're on the other side. And so the reason I thought to do this talk was because I just did a session with someone. And so I'm very consistent about, okay, close the door as soon as you're through, close it behind you, close the door behind you, close the door behind you, close the door behind you. And so we were actually in her soul tree, and she had an aspect of the tree that appeared that was kind of a new aspect. It wasn't new, but it was one that was hidden until this session. And so there was a door to go through, and I did, and it's just by habit. And I was like, close the door when you get through. And then I was like, oh no, wait, no, you don't have to close that door. That door can stay open. Then I was like, I am such a door closer. And she started laughing. And I was like, I don't know why that's funny. Why is that so funny? But from certain perspectives, you know, are you closing doors? And so it really made me kind of dive into the thinking behind, like, my subconscious thinking behind these doors. So again, I use them a lot when we're journeying to that other side, because it keeps the integrity of the veil, right? It keeps that boundary protected so that you're not leaving it open and other stuff can just come in uninvited. But sometimes there are doors that don't need to be closed, especially if they're doors within your spirit. Which is what happened in that journey. And so I had to back myself up and be like, oh, no, no, wait, that door can stay open. All the doors don't have to be closed. Okay, so doors also symbolize potential and transitions. So when you have a door, you are entering into often, not necessarily a new realm, like brand new, but new to you or new to your awareness. And so this is a new phase. And so it really does represent potential and the potential of a transition. So you're moving from one space into another, and that door is the demarcation. Another thing, I don't know that I really, I'm just going to mention it. It might be a future podcast, but it's been coming up a lot. It's the idea of, excuse me, I don't know what happened to me here. It's the idea of the singularity. So, you know, we have a universe, we have a black hole. The black hole is sucking in, right? It's sucking in material. Within the black hole, there's a singularity. At least this is what we're theorizing. Within the black hole, and spirit tells me this is true, there's a singularity. So the singularity is the point where it flips, like it turns itself inside out. So we go from the black hole consuming to the singularity that flips, and now it becomes a point of creation. And so the idea is that this singularity might be like the Big Bang, that point of origin. And so to see this whole cyclic pattern, you have the universe that feeds the black hole, you have the singularity that flips and becomes a white hole and becomes that point of creation that births a new universe. And then that cycle repeats like that. Things happen on a concept. Again, I'm kind of getting off track, but this idea of a holographic universe that everything is fractal. And so what we see at our human level is reflected at various scales. So we'll see it reflected in the micro world. We'll see it reflected in the macro world. And so this pattern that I'm talking about of a universe being consumed by a black hole, going through the singularity and emerging as a white hole and point of creation for a new universe, is our cycle of life and death as humans. And so this just reiterates that all things go through this cycle. Bringing it back to the symbolism of a door, that point of singularity is the door. It is the transition point. It's where it flips. You go from one state into another. And so that's the potential of a door. And so sometimes if you come up on a closed door, there's a little hesitation to move through it because you are going to be essentially like almost flipped inside out. Like you're going from one state into another. Some of the other symbolism you might encounter with the door would be doors that require access. So the implication there is that in order to transition from one level to another, there's some sort of experience or mastery that needs to be obtained. You need the key. So a key is another symbol that I see a lot in my work where people will see keys. And it's like, it's the clue to look for the door. Like it's like the, like the trophy saying, okay, you have reached the point where you have the mastery to unlock a door, find the door. Like it's really the signpost leading you to look for, I'm at the point I need to find a transition. It's time for me to go from this phase into the next phase. So keys also are very important. Also, I just have notes here. So the key, but also locks, kind of go hand in hand, right? So if something is locked, you're just not quite ready. Doorknobs, like the different types of doorknobs can be important. I don't want to go super deep into that, but it is something that often I'll look at when we're doing a journey. If a client mentions like a certain doorknob, it can have relevance. So if you're dreaming of doors, that's something to pay attention to as well. If it pops up, if it presents itself, if things don't present themselves, then usually it's not, there's nothing there. So, don't stress if you have a dream about a door and a knob isn't apparently obvious. We often see doors have guardians. So they're, again, those points of protection. So when we talk about, portals or doors between the realms, often they are guarded. So one other type of door that I want to talk about really quick is the yoni opening. And so if you see the yoni opening, so the yoni opening, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, is basically like it's like a vaginal opening where the opening just exists. It's never really closed. And so if you encounter the yoni opening, and a lot of my clients do, that means that's a door that, it's a door that is open and it's always open. It's a place that has been traveled through and traversed, that it is just an opening. It is no longer a transition point. I'm hoping that makes sense because it's kind of hard to put it into words, but it is still a door, but it is no longer connected to a transition, in the realm of, in the realm of moving or growing from one point into another. It is still a transition in that you're moving from one space to another, but both of those spaces are very known, well-known, and well-traveled for the soul aspect. I'm trying to think of, for some reason it's popping up for me like in a game, it's not going to come to me, but there is a game where it's like, once you unlock the door just kind of stays open and you can just move in and out without like doing the quest associated with the door. Okay. So it's like the quest has been met to unlock the door. Now the door is just, it just becomes like a passageway instead of an actual, closing off. There's also some symbolism around the door with dualism. So I'm just mentioning it because it can just kind of be again, as like the signpost into some further lessons or considerations. So consider a door is like a switch on a train track. Okay. So going back to the yoni, actually, it's like you had a switch on a train track and it still exists there, but you're no longer able to actually activate the switch. The track just goes to one track. So it's like the point of potential, the point of choice has been removed. The decision has already been made or the quest has already been completed. And so it just stays open. But when you have an actual door, an actual closing there, it is like a switch on a train track. And so there, it is a point of decision. It's a point of, choice. And I mean, often for free will, I mean, we still, again, I don't know that I want to go down this road, but we have, as human beings, we have, it gets a little complicated in terms of, we have free will, but we also have like this divine purpose. And so when we have these switches on the train track, it is a point of choice and we can make a choice. Now that doesn't mean that if we make a particular choice, we're not going to circle back around to that switch again. So I'll just leave it at that. But it is a point of choice. So when you're looking at a door, when you come up, some of the things you might notice are, for more consideration, are open versus closed, locked versus unlocked, guarded versus unguarded. Okay. Finally, I want to go back to that idea of closing doors. So like I said, I'm a door closer and I actually have people in my house. It's so funny. I have people in my house that leave doors open all the time. And I'm not just talking about room doors. I'm talking about cabinet doors, drawers. They just leave everything open. It drives me crazy. I'll come out. It'll look like a poltergeist has come in through the night and like all the doors are open, cabinet doors are open. And I know it's not a poltergeist cause I watch my people do it. So I'm always like, close the doors. And why? Because if you leave those cabinet doors open, what happens? You know, you get all this dust and crap in your cabinets and your dishes aren't clean anymore. So that's one idea, keeping these doors closed so that you're not getting a lot of debris in your field. And of course, when I'm talking about doors now, you know, the doors can be a lot of different things. I'll give you another example. So a couple years ago, I was diagnosed with melanoma and it's fine, it's resolved. But recently I had to go back to the dermatologist for a follow-up, and the dermatologist, I had to see a new one because of all the COVID craziness. In order to get in, I had to see somebody different, and she wanted to biopsy a spot that I knew wasn't anything. And so when I was relating this to a friend, I was just feeling very annoyed. You know, on one hand, I guess I could have been grateful that she was, you know, really being cautious, but here's where my annoyance came in, because I said, I know it's not anything. I am really annoyed that now she has opened up this door that now somebody has to close, and that somebody is going to have to be me. So what I was saying there was that she opened up this potential that even though I knew it wasn't anything, now the potential that it could be something was going to weigh on me in the form of worry. And so it was a door I had to go close, because if you don't close it, energy just keeps pouring through. I've also Often talked with friends about closing the door to different opportunities. And that once, you know, once I see an opportunity is no longer viable, you know, I want to close the door. And so I'll often say it in these terms, like, yeah, I'm just talking to them to figure out what opportunities still exist there so that I can close that door if possible. And the reason I want to close the door is I don't want to keep pouring my energy into a project that really has no life and no potential. So closing the door, because it conserves my energy. So especially at a time when my energy is not super great, I need to close off some of the doors. You know, it's like if you're trying to heat or cool your house and you leave all your doors wide open, it's going to be very difficult to maintain the climate in your house. You've got to close some doors. And so the same thing here. Relationships, another one. If a relationship is not working, close the door. Here's the thing. A door can be reopened. I mean, sometimes it can. This is not like burning bridges, though. So when you burn a bridge, it's over. It's done. You got to build a new bridge, which takes a lot. If you're talking about a door, though, you can close the door. Somebody can knock. If the potential revives, the person can knock on the door, and you have the choice to open it or not. So I love the analogy of the door in terms of preservation of your energy, your sovereignty, your sovereignty, your boundaries, your energy. So doors, so yes, we kind of have this idea of like, oh, you close the door. Like, you know, we don't necessarily have to slam the door in somebody's face, but there's nothing wrong with closing doors. You know, you just may not want to, or you may not want to brick it over or seal it up in some way. Sometimes you do though. And that is also, one avenue of really closing something down. Let's see the last symbolism of the door. If you are a healer, and actually not if, everybody is a healer, whether or not that is your profession or whether or not that is one of your key archetypes, everybody is a healer. Everybody has that potential to offer healing to another human being. But what does that mean? We forget this so, so often. And so some of you may or may not know my full story, but I just mentioned that I had melanoma. 6 months after that, my husband was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. So it was a rough few years, and to say the least. When my husband was diagnosed with cancer, we had some differences. We just had different philosophies on healing. And what really got driven home for me, so this was one of my biggest critical lessons in terms of being a healer, is that, and I knew it, you know, this is the thing about lessons, right? We'll think we've learned it, we've checked the box, but there's always a deepening. And so the deepening lesson for me was that as a healer, I cannot heal anybody else. I can't. We can only heal what is inside of us when we are looking at something external to us. And it doesn't matter if it's a stranger, if it's someone we love the most in the world, it doesn't matter. As soon as it is outside of us, external, we cannot do the healing work. And so when my husband was sick, I was constantly from spirit getting the image. You as a healer are only, and only is not a great term, but you are the doorman, the door holder. Your only job is to hold the door open. You can't make him go through. You can't push him through. You can't pick up his bags and carry them through for him. He has to carry his stuff and go through the door. The only thing you can do is hold it open. You can show him there's a door and you can hold it open. And that is it. That is it. We are not bellhops. We are not as healers. We are not porters. We don't carry stuff. We don't carry people through. We don't carry their stuff through, their bags, their whatever needs to go through the door. And so that, I think that's really critical to remember. If you're a healer, I think that is the most appropriate symbol ever. Like we can have this very heightened sense of what it means to be a healer, but at the end of the day, you're a doorman and all you do is hold the door. So, okay, well, didn't intend to talk for an hour. Apparently I have a lot to say. So thank you so much for listening. I appreciate it. I hope you got something valuable out of this discussion. And I will talk to you again very soon. Thanks. Take care.